Welcome to Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Camilla McGibbon.
So let's get in on a big meaty subject, shall we? How's your knowledge of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Keith, Camilla?
Yeah, not quite as good as yours, because I'm not reading it.
I know Eleanor Roosevelt was involved. I know it was a sort of great moment. There is Article 14, which is everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. I just want to start by just asking us, you know, when you see another story on the front of a tabloid newspaper about people clambering off boats on Mediterranean islands, what do you feel, Keith, Camilla, when you see those sort of stories again and again?
I think part of the problem is you become blind to them, that they are so often, there's so many, there's a lot of charities out there, you know, coming on for we need funding about it. And the sadness is it loses the power and the feeling of concern.
The difficulty for anybody campaigning on behalf of people who have less, let's put it that way, is that they have to pitch up that level of excitement so that we all go, this is dreadful, and either lobby our MP or pitch money the way of the charity.
Building on that, I've never lived in a period same as we are now, okay, where there are so many people now becoming unemployed, so many people that are losing their financial support. So all those people that you normally look for support for, people like, you know, refugees and that, they're facing their own problems. So that balance of how do I deal with this of my own and my family and my friends, and then also do I support other people coming from other countries? I think this is a huge one for us at the moment.
So our guest today is running one of the largest charities dealing with refugees and asylum seekers, and that's Stephen Hale, Chief Executive of Refugee Action. What are you hoping to glean from today's conversation?
One of the things I'm looking to try and get from him is information on how his organisation, which is a national organisation, how are they supporting other refugee charities around the country?
Camilla?
Given that he's a huge organisation with a high profile, I want to know how much now of his time is spent with government, either lobbying, influencing, and how much of his time is spent directly with refugees.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think another sort of thing we need to try and drill down is how is COVID affecting currently refugees and asylum seekers?
We'll wait to hear from Stephen Hale, Chief Executive of Refugee Action. Since February 2015, Stephen Hale has been Chief Executive of Refugee Action. It's a national charity that aims to enable all asylum seekers and refugees to access justice and rebuild their lives successfully in Britain. Prior to this, Stephen was at Oxfam International as Deputy Advocacy and Campaigns Director from 2010 to 2015. But Refugee Action was founded in 1981 in response to the arrival of Vietnamese refugees in the UK, the boat people as they became known. Today, it's one of the UK's major refugee charities, helping more than 1,700 refugees to rebuild their lives in the UK in 2017-18. Stephen's background is in campaigning and advocacy, and he was famously Third Sector Magazine's Chief Executive of the Year for 2019. Woo. Did you get a glorious Woo. Rosette and a bag of money, Stephen?
Sadly not. I think I've got two more weeks until someone takes the trophy.
Well, it's great to have you with us. First of all, what drew you to the organisation Refugee Action in 2015 when you went for the chief exec job?
Well, I was first approached by a headhunter, and they emailed me and they said, would I be interested in applying to be the chief executive of Refugee Action? And I replied and said no, because although it's a cause which certainly I hold dear, I could see that the organisation had overwhelmingly a focus on service delivery and relied for the vast majority of its income on contracts from central government. And to be fair, no sensible board would appoint me to run such an organisation. So I suggested that I wouldn't apply. And it was at that point that they explained that the charity wanted to take a new direction. They recognised that that model, not just from a financial perspective, but more from an impact perspective, had sort of run its course, and that there were and there are many brilliant people in Refugee Action who have that knowledge and experience, and that they wanted to find a chief exec that would help them to build a different approach. And that's obviously what I've done.
And that move was sort of speeded up somewhat, wasn't it? Because you arrived at the organisation in February 2015, and then, well, you tell us the story. What happened next?
Well, so I joined in at end of February 2015, and in June, on a very hot day, I went to the shop over the road and went and bought about 25 ice creams, and I came back and handed them out, and then I went back into my office, and the Home Office phoned and said that they were going to bring back into central government a contract which at that time provided over more than 70% of our income. So of 150 staff, that meant 110 people would be made redundant, which obviously was a devastating blow for all those people and a huge challenge for the organisation, a huge loss to the people who provided that service, and also a massive deterrent for me to buy ice creams again.
How did you pick yourself up off the floor when you'd had that news?
Well, the first thing I did was think about a close friend of mine who I'd been for a drink with him to discuss whether I should apply for the job. And I said to him, they have this big contract and it comes up for tender. Tell me more about winning government contracts. And he said, oh, you'll be fine. It'll be fine. So when I got this call, I did think I must give Ian a ring and thank him for that sterling advice.
And he's still your mate, is he?
He is, actually. Although that was a huge shock, it liberated us as well. You know, we had a very large central government contract that dominated the work of 70% of the people in the organisation. And that was a big, big suck on the focus of the management team. So to a certain extent, you know, it meant, OK, fine, we really do need to get on and be the organisation we want to be. But at that time, clearly, as a sort of, you know, very new chief exec who was looking forward to leading and developing and delivering strategy for 150 people, to then think we're going to be doing it for 40 was a shock. But that first 2 years in post was incredibly turbulent, and Refugee Action now has around 120 staff. So you can see that there have been many twists and turns in that period, just as there have been in British public attitudes and in the debate on refugees, asylum seekers and migration over the past 5 years. It's obviously a very polarised subject, and there are times in which you feel the country is very much behind you, and at times where you feel that they're not.
Camilla.
It's fascinating that you bring the word in turbulent, Stephen, because I have felt over this whole year really a sense of deja vu. Your organization started at the time for the Vietnamese boat people, and 40 years on, we almost have, it's not been labeled yet by the likes of, say, the Daily Mail, but the Kent boat people coming in from Calais on these tiny little dinghies, landing in Kent. You're the chief exec of an organization that has to deal with a lot of this, that has to certainly lobby about it. Have you got any thoughts on solutions?
Clearly, this has become a real touchstone issue and a hugely emotive issue. And ultimately, I'd maybe recall one conversation that for me encapsulates it, which I had with a special advisor to a new Home Secretary, not the current one. And I said to them, when you're the Home Secretary, you've really got two choices. You can tell a story to the country which says that people do end up in the UK because we live in a war that's characterised by high levels of war and persecution. And those people come here with great trauma and having been through a huge amount, and Britain can respond to that and we can be part of that. Or you can play on people's fears and you can say, oh, you know, these people are coming, we don't know where they're from and it's all out of control and, you know, something must be done. And I said, that at the end of the day is a moral choice for people in leadership positions.
Yeah.
While there are sort of block of people, if you like, on either end of those debates who aren't going to move, you know, people who support migration of all kinds or people who for various reasons are hostile to migration, more or less of all kinds, the vast majority of people, it depends how you tell the story. And at the moment, I feel that the people who've got the megaphone are telling a story that builds public concern and anxiety. And it's hard, obviously, for any one individual charity to counter that. But that's our task, is to build public support.
So if you're only one charity, as you say, and you gain strength by banding together, so collaboration is something that I know you're very enthusiastic about. How do you create, as it were, a slogan or something that will capture people's hope and confront hostility?
I think collaboration is the right thing to do, and it's also absolutely the most impactful thing to do. It's not always, obviously, the thing that's going to raise you the most money, but charities don't exist to raise money. They exist to make a difference.
Hear, hear.
And so what we have done, and I speak not for Refugee Action here, but for a number of, you know, national asylum refugee charities. So Refugee Action, Refugee Council, the British Red Cross, Freedom from Torture, Scottish Refugee. So a number of us have come together to establish the Asylum Reform Initiative. And we have a member of staff whose role is to work with us to build a long-term shared influencing strategy. Because all of our organisations have exactly the same goals, more or less, in terms of what we want to see from government. And particularly when you're faced with a pretty intimidating target in terms of where central government is coming from, it's absolutely imperative that we bind more closely together.
Keith?
Yeah, I want to take you slightly back on the bit about how the country feels at the moment. We're living in an environment with COVID where many people now are losing their jobs. They're struggling themselves. So those people that may have volunteered, that would have funded, are you seeing a difference now in that sort of field?
I think that in times of economic hardship, people's capacity to be generous at an individual level giving to charity or to think generously about public policy solutions is constrained. But I think ultimately these are values questions as well. And it's important that we frame them in ways that reach beyond our narrow base. You know, you can tell the same story in ways that work or don't. So for instance, you could say we want to see 50,000 people who've, you know, been affected by war and conflict come to the UK through safe and legal means. And many people would respond to that by saying 50,000 people, you know, we can't cope with that. But if you said to them, we want to bring two families to every town in Britain, they'd say, absolutely, of course we must. And that might be 80,000. So it's how we tell the story.
On that point, does it not frustrate you sometimes that you still have to argue that there is a right to seeking asylum, in a sense, even though it was declared in the UN Declaration on Human Rights decades ago?
One of the things that has not ceased to amaze me in the 5.5 years I've been doing this job is just how many things we have to talk about that we shouldn't have to talk about.
Yeah.
I would say that well over half of the campaigns that we run at Refugee Action are campaigns where we're trying to persuade the Home Office to do something which they themselves are committed to doing, they just don't bloody do. So people who are constantly left destitute because their forms are lost, their cases are not followed through, they don't get a fair hearing, they don't have the process explained to them through a lawyer. These are operational failures with hugely significant human impacts. The first campaign that I ran at Refugee Action, which we were, you know, partially successful, the government gave an additional £10 million in funding, was a campaign to increase funding for English language classes for refugees. I mean, in the, whatever it is, several years we've worked on this issue, I've not found either a member of the public or a member of parliament who doesn't think that it makes sense for people who've come to the UK, who have refugee status, to be taught the language of our country so that they can talk to their neighbours, seek work, and yet English language funding classes, not just for refugees, but for all people in the UK, has more than halved in the past decade. So we're having to argue for things which really, you know, I can't believe we're here, but we are, and that's where we've got to build from.
Camilla.
Yeah. If you had a Marcus Rashford who simply tweeted, as I understand it, about the fact that when he was a young boy, he didn't have enough to eat. Somehow I think there needs to be a visible champion, and it needs to be a champion that somehow has come through hardship but looks visibly fantastic now. You're a campaigner. Is it something you've thought?
I think the messenger is very important. And, you know, the less that I'm doing TV and broadcast because people seeking asylum are telling their own story, the better. You know, that's what's going to reach people and connect them and make them think, my goodness me, what that person's been through is something no person should have to go through, and I want the UK to support that person. So I think it's empowering for the individual, if as long as they have the right support around them. And I think you're right about messengers. And of course, there are many footballers in the Premier League who have refugee status. Some of them are British and some of them come from other countries. But one can't generalise because people sometimes react against that. And they would, you know, but the Marcus Rashford story is absolutely inspirational and certainly a lesson in terms of, you know, how transformational that kind of intervention can be.
Yeah.
On the issue about refugees and the asylum seekers coming into the country, it was 40 years ago when I was the assistant director in East Yorkshire in one of the authorities, and we got the boat people, the Vietnamese, coming in, and I was given the task to lead our task force of how we integrated them. And we took a decision of sharing them all around the big city. I think if I was to do that now, I think that was the wrong thing for us to do, because they all tended to come back to the centre to talk to each other. How then are we going to handle the situation of where we can successfully locate people if these numbers are going to get bigger and bigger for us?
Firstly, the numbers aren't getting bigger, they're getting smaller.
Okay.
The profile of the issue is obviously very high in the past 3 months. But no, the number of people reaching the UK and claiming asylum has fallen very steeply since March 2020.
Is that COVID?
Yeah.
So because the airlines aren't running, they're not coming in?
That's right. The visibility of the issue is high because people see people coming through boats. The second thing I would say is that there are two groups in the UK that Refugee Action works with. First is people who make their own journey and then claim asylum and await a decision by the Home Office as to whether they meet the UN's definition of a refugee. The second is people who come in a safe and legal way, right? And the primary means for that is that the government, back in September 2015, at that huge moment of public consciousness and concern for refugees, committed to welcome 20,000 Syrians over 5 years through a resettlement programme. That was a completely voluntary programme. And if no local authority in the country had wanted to do it, no Syrian refugees would have come to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But over 200 local authorities did choose to do it because there was public support in their areas. In Herefordshire, Worcestershire, areas where there are no people seeking asylum. Mm. And I can tell you, the first time I went to Hereford, I mean, there was a clamour. There were people who'd been waiting decades in Hereford for refugees to arrive, basically. You know, they were very excited about it. What you actually saw was a huge diversification in the distribution of refugees in the UK, because local authorities are putting their hands up and saying, can I have some?
Yeah. I coach and mentor a number of charity chief execs, one of which is running a refugees and asylum seekers charity in Wales. I asked her about what was the sort of questions she would ask you. Okay. The first one is, how are you working with the Home Office to make positive change?
I have worked with many different government departments, you know, in my campaigns and advocacy life, but I've never worked with an organisation like the Home Office. I mean, it is deeply, deeply dysfunctional. And I have quite a lot of sympathy with the senior staff there, because once you're in a dysfunctional organisation, it's pretty difficult to turn around.
Yeah.
Certainly pretty difficult if the ministers to whom you're accountable don't want to turn it round and aren't actually that concerned about the extent to which it protects vulnerable people. And frankly, the asylum system generates safeguarding risk as a matter of policy.
How does it work when, as you've admitted, you know, the government of the day does not take calls from refugee charities? That is still happening, isn't it?
It is.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I've had this job for 5.5 years and this has never happened before, you know. When Theresa May was Home Secretary, when I took this job, I had regular meetings with James Brokenshire, who was the Immigration Minister. And yet since December 2019, there has been no contact. It really is an extraordinary situation for a government to go through 6 months of a global pandemic when you have a group of people in the UK who don't speak English, who are clearly extremely vulnerable, that we know are disproportionately affected by the pandemic. Even if they don't want to discuss Calais crossings with us, there are any number of critical issues which are potentially literally life and death around the safety and well-being of people and their level of understanding and their financial ability to comply with COVID guidelines, for instance. You know, it is an absolute scandal and I will never get used to it. This government, I'm afraid, has to be shamed into re-engaging.
I was going to bring in Alex Scales, Director of the Centre for Charity Effectiveness, on this, because, Alex, this must be something that you come across an awful lot, the chief execs and the charities that face a change of regime, opposition, the Iron Curtain comes down, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we've been hearing about, you know, time and time again, particularly since COVID, in terms of how can the charity sector make itself more relevant to those policymakers and those in governments. And I wonder what your thoughts might be on that, Stephen.
Well, I think the first thing is to be honest about where we are. And clearly we are at a low point, at least in recent history, because we do have a government that doesn't understand or appreciate or respect the contribution that the voluntary sector makes to many causes which the British people hold very dear. And, you know, in many villages, towns and cities, the organisations that play an incredibly important role. And so we have got to find ways to tell a much better story about the incredible role that charities play in Britain. You know, I mean, the government's always looking to be world-beating or world-class. And one thing that is truly world-class about Britain is its charities.
And so where do you think we've been going wrong in recent years in terms of the communication? Because there's been a big noise about moving to more statistical measurement of outcomes and impact, and that doesn't seem to be capturing the ear of government. And in the absence of mainstream media wanting to pick up the positive stories around the charity sector, there's a gap somewhere to be filled by some body, some group to really make that noise.
I don't think it's primarily a data problem. I think it's a storytelling challenge. I think we've got to cut through on this. And I think ultimately, to be honest, and I say this with huge respect for the new leadership there, I think ultimately this is why we have the National Council of Voluntary Organisations. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's them that has to tell this story, but it is a challenge which I feel that they hold on all of our behalf, and to which obviously we can contribute different ideas.
Keith?
The rest of the charities in the country who are dealing with refugees and asylum seekers, how do you work with them, and how would you defend the added value you bring by being a national charity?
I think the first thing I'd say is that the asylum refugee sector is particularly fragmented. If you go to Huddersfield, or you go to Leeds, or you go to Newcastle, or you go to Middlesbrough, there will be a local charity, you know, set up by local people who saw the need, who secured the funding. And so we've got a network of small frontline organisations, and no national charity should seek to supplant or undermine the work that those organisations do. So the question is always, how can we make the whole sector better? And so at Refugee Action, since 2015, we've had what we call a good practice team that supports other charities. And there's been an explosion in that connection and collaboration since March 2020, since COVID-19, because all charities face exactly the same challenges.
Absolutely.
You know, just to give the most basic and immediate of examples, all of these asylum charities make destitution payments. They put cash into the hands of people who haven't got a bed to go to that night, or haven't got food for the next 24 hours. And of course, when all those organisations were closed, they all had to work out, how do you make a payment remotely? None of them had systems for that. We brought organisations together and we put together advice and guidance, and we said, you could try this. It has the following pros and cons. And that's what we've done over the past 6 months, is to identify common problems and work with organisations, not to say Refugee Action says you must do X, but to say to them, what are you doing? And to pool that learning.
Has there been learning in the other direction as well, Stephen, in terms of from the small organisations? We typically see a lot amongst our student bodies of the sort of small, fleet of foot, agile, newly set up organisations that really started, I guess, at the time when Calais first hit our papers and screens. But interesting to hear what learning the larger organisations such as yours might be deriving from their approach and the way that they work.
Well, I would say that in the wake of the Refugees Welcome Movement in September 2015, hundreds of new organisations emerged, as you said, some of them with a focus on Calais or on Greece or elsewhere, but many of them campaigning locally. And that's the reason why Herefordshire and Worcestershire and Shropshire, that I mentioned earlier, are resettling refugees. In this current crisis, in the groups that we're bringing together in relation to COVID-19, they're the more established local charities, if I can put it that way. It's been a collaboration with trusts and foundations. So 8 different trusts and foundations have given us quite significant grants. So we've distributed about over £2 million to these local charities alongside the support and advice work. It's been a dreadful crisis, but it's certainly brought people together in ways that I think we can confidently and tangibly say have really helped charities to respond more effectively.
There's clearly been a massive focus in recent years around governance. And of course, we have to raise the fact you were at Oxfam International before becoming chief exec of Refugee Action. And you saw what happened there, the scandal involving aid workers using local prostitutes in various parts of the world. But when you heard that news, that story started to break. How did you feel?
Well, it's heartbreaking because, you know, I know many people who, when I was there and you know, even today, obviously, have given, you know, very large parts of their working lives and gone well above the cause because they believe passionately in the goals Oxfam has and the work that it does. But clearly, no institution, big or small, is immune from, you know, making serious mistakes or from learning lessons. And Oxfam has clearly done that. But I don't think safeguarding is an issue for Oxfam. I think safeguarding is an issue for the voluntary sector.
Camilla.
Can I just say something about having grown up in Canada, in a country that pretty much welcomed refugees? When I was growing up, it was mostly East Europeans that were fleeing communism. And one of the things that you learn almost by osmosis is that when countries welcome people, the people that they welcome and support are incredibly grateful. They work incredibly hard. They have huge values around education and bettering themselves, which in the long run betters the country. How can we not make that a very simple statement?
Well, many of us can. You just did.
Oh, thank you.
But the stories that central government is choosing to tell at the moment clearly run counter to that.
So that's a choice. That's not an inability, in your view.
It is absolutely a choice.
Stephen, I think we've exhausted our time with you, and it's been fantastic to hear your thoughts about where you are at the moment, where the organisation is at the moment. In 10 years' time, when you look back on this period, when we all look back on this period and we look remember these images of boats coming over, do you think we will think we did a good thing or we did a bad thing? We didn't cope as well as we should have done.
Britain is not making the scale of contribution or the quality of contribution it could make to the global refugee crisis. I think we can be proud of the level of international development spend, but certainly in relation to the scope of our own work, the way in which we support people or respond to people who come to the UK having been through all that trauma and lost so much, I think at the moment we have little to be proud of, and it's one of the things that motivates me, you know, that there are some big changes that we need to make, and we need to build coalitions that make that irresistible for politicians.
Stephen Hale, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm really surprised in a way that someone like Stephen is prepared to talk in the way that he did there. Not only about the relationship with government, but the relationship with other organisations. You know, that line he has about collaboration, about how it's actually morally unacceptable not to collaborate in certain circumstances, a real challenge to other people working in the sector, and maybe a sense that it hasn't always worked as well as it should be. And I get the sense that he doesn't really mind who he upsets. He just is utterly focused on a vision. As a leader, he's utterly focused on a vision for the future.
I think he comes across as highly reflective, and I think that really comes across as a strength. So, you know, we have leaders out there who tend to shoot from the hip, but actually someone who is as reflective as he is, when the passion comes to the fore and you can see the enthusiasm and equally the frustration, a little bit of what came through this afternoon, I hope that people will begin to take notice if this situation continues.
Camilla?
I cannot see the government giving anything if they won't even take a phone call. It's not like everything we discuss isn't serious, but this looks serious. And it's like you're up against both a rock and a hard place.
Keith?
I just think he was a thinker. And like you, David, he was prepared to speak out, to throw down the gauntlet, and to be honest, you know, I don't think they're listening. I don't think they're doing this or whatever. And I think there are lessons to learn there. The strong one for me was he was so positive that it was the stories that were going to make the difference. So if local charities now start thinking about who have I got within our charity that can tell a good story, then that's maybe what we should be focusing on to get our message out there.
Alex?
We are seeing positives coming out of this awful COVID situation, but in terms of it's a great opportunity to build a community, to make more noise to government and to be able to articulate your needs. And I think that's something that needs to be replicated across the sector, not just to government, but to all their stakeholders in terms of building that narrative, aggregating it, and getting that real groundswell of noise up and out.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We'll be back with more episodes very soon. This has been one of a series of conversations about leadership challenges through COVID within the charity sector, supported by the City Bridge Trust. We're very grateful to them. Our thanks to the Centre for Charity Effectiveness, to Dan Hardoon and to Whistledown Studios for production, and we look forward to you joining us soon. Goodbye.